This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Very soon you're going to hear the details of the NFF's drought policy. And I'm asking you today, would you take an exit grant to leave farming? 0467 922 783. Really interested to hear from you on this. Also this half hour, the ACCC's inquiry into the water market will begin across the Murray-Darling Basin soon. So you're going to hear from Duxton Water and their response to allegations it's hoarding water at the expense of farmers. And mushroom waste sunscreen and skincare products from Berries, you'll hear about a new research lab turning waste into high-value products.
This research is really for the primary producers and to help them amplify the value of their waste and the value of their crops overall. And to do that, we will just use our knowledge and research capabilities to support them the best we can.
More on that later, but first today, if it won't rain, what's the next best thing to help farmers manage the drought? The National Farmers Federation has written to the Prime Minister asking him to consider exit packages to help farmers leave the land. Now, is that something that you would consider taking up? 0467 922 783 to have your say. It's one way that the NFF believes government can help in this current drought, but it's also got a few ideas about how to help in future droughts. Kath Sullivan asked its president, Fiona Simpson, to explain what the NFF is seeking.
We're suggesting that the government establish two groups, and one of them is a committee, the governance committee that actually oversees any actual implementation of the policy, which would include the Commonwealth government, all levels of government for that matter, farming organisations and community organisations, and then also a drought forum that actually brings together all stakeholders to discuss the full scope of issues related to drought. Now, those two things alone would actually provide fundamental change to the way that the governments currently, and it's not just the federal government, all governments currently handle drought, which they do in isolation at a state or a federal level.
This national drought policy is about droughts into the future. Have you done any costings associated with what it is that you're seeking? Is this about more money?
It's not necessarily about more money at all, but it is about more equitable distribution of funds that are put on the table to a wider section of the community and a wider section of our farming community as well. So we know that drought doesn't just affect farmers, it does affect small businesses and communities as well. And what we do know is that the way that we currently respond to drought, that is generally ignoring it until we're in the midst of it, means that the government's money that is put on the table is actually tends to be distributed to a relatively small section of the community as safety net provisions and support payments. We would like to see a more proactive approach where we can all prepare for drought each and every day, where funds that are put on the table are seen to be more widely available and can actually actively assist farmers and farm businesses in becoming more resilient and supported during the good times and the bad.
And Fiona Simpson, as part of this request to government, you have issued six priorities you'd like the government to consider in terms of addressing this current drought. Why is that about this current drought and not about all droughts?
Well, this current drought, we haven't had time to prepare. It is an extraordinarily severe drought, and we haven't had any, if we actually put in place our national drought policy, then we'll be able to prepare for future drought. But right now, we're in uncharted waters, uncharted territories, and the regions and agriculture is hurting badly. As the drought goes on, you know, people are really being impacted, and many, many people are not able to access assistance in any way. We do think the government needs to look carefully and continue to look carefully, which they have been doing, at ways to lift their efforts and to provide support and relief to these communities as the drought continues. So we've proposed measures that are going to be help a wide variety of people, things like local council rate relief, the subsidising of payroll expenses, top-up payments of the assistance for isolated children allowance, interest-free periods for regional investment corporation loans, etc. So there's a number of measures there that we've written to government about to consider in terms of stepping up support for this current drought.
And one of those measures is to provide exit packages for farming families who want to get out. Could you tell me how you envisage that would work?
Again, you know, we're suffering from a lack of data in terms of when these measures have been put on the table before. But we do believe that there are a number of families now that are really considering their future. Unfortunately, drought is one of those things that you know, really severely impacts some families to the extent, and some businesses to the extent, where they are considering their future options. And we do believe that if government was to assist some of these businesses with exit packages, then it could actually provide some real support for those people who are going through a very, very difficult time.
That's Fiona Simpson, the president of the National Farmers Federation. Its future drought policy was handed to government last week, and from today it's also available on the NFF website. Keen to hear from you today on this, about what you think about those ideas that the NFF is putting forward, particularly that last one about offering exit grants. Would you take an exit grant to leave farming? It's a big question. 0467 922 783 if you'd like to have your say. You can also give us a call on 1300 222 891. Well, in some good news, Oruroo is the South Australian winner of Rural Aid's first 10-town makeover initiative. The town will get $100,000 and volunteers to help work on projects in the community. Oruroo Carrington Community Project Officer Jodie Bowley explains what they'll do with the money.
So we've been given up to $100,000. $10,000 is to employ a small town renewal consultant expert that will come in and work with some of our town leaders on some project initiatives, and we'll define that scope. And then $90,000 that will go towards materials for that project that we do identify. And then we actually have up between 50 to 100 volunteers through Rural Aid that they call the Farm Army of Volunteers that will spend a week in our community helping us with that particular project.
Great. You know, when people are doing it tough because of drought, I suppose $100,000 is a drop in the bucket, so to speak. Yeah. But part of it must be... the effect of an award like this must be the people in the town think, oh, we're not forgotten.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, the number one thing that we in the community have been concentrating on has been the wellbeing of the people of the community and the broader community. And, you know, that's the number one concern. But with news like this, it does lift a bit of confidence in positivity, you know, and belief in our local economy. And, yeah, it gives us heaps of support.
So what do you think you're going to do with the money?
Well, there's a couple of initiatives that we did put forward in our application, and that ranged with complementing the historic value of our town, particularly our main street. We were also along the Peatner Creek here, and there's an awesome walking trail there that you know, needs some priority work. We put that forward as well. And tourism is something that we've really looked at as a community, so we've put some things forward in that. But it really is up to the community individuals that have already stepped forward, showing us their passion and their wishes to work on a particular project.
That is Oru Carrington Community Project Officer Jodie Bowley speaking there to David Bevan. Good on Oru, and I'm really looking forward to seeing transformation there is for that town as part of Rural Aid's first 10 town makeover initiative. It is a 12:15.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Public hearings for the ACCC's inquiry into the water market are going to begin across the Murray-Darling Basin in the next 2 weeks. Now, the competition watchdog is looking into allegations investors are hoarding water rights at the expense of farmers. One of the firms accused of hoarding is South Australian-based company Duxton Water. Alastair Walsh is the Director of Water Assets at Duxton Capital, and he's speaking here to RN's Hamish McDonald, who asked him if the hoarding accusation was true.
Well, the answer is ultimately no, Hamish. We've certainly built a portfolio of permanent water rights, and ultimately that's really on the back of a growing trend where irrigators are not covering themselves with their own rights in the current conditions. They're looking at different ways that they can satisfy that input and ultimately use their capital in their own businesses. We're really just satisfying a demand to fulfil that water input requirement that they have.
The assertion is that speculation is pushing up the price of water, and that it's gone from a long-term average of about $135 a megalitre to $800 a megalitre. It's a big jump, I'm sure you'd acknowledge. How do you explain that rise?
Yeah, and look, I think it's good to have some historic context to, you know, the current pricing. Ultimately, this is the first significantly dry period we've come into since the millennial drought back in the late 2000s. And ultimately, through that period, certainly 2007, we saw pricing in allocation water, which is the usable component that irrigators actually use to irrigate their crops, jumped to $1,100 to $1,200 a megalitre. So inflationary adjusted, you're probably talking about $1,400 to $1,500 a megalitre in today's dollars. At the moment, we're operating around that $800 to $900 mark, and we're in a very challenging, dry situation at the moment. Our role in the market at the moment is really to ensure, we're providing our irrigation partners with visible water supply, and that's ultimately what we're doing.
But do you speculate? Is that what you do? Do you speculate in the water market?
No, look, we're a long-term investor in the space. We're actually an irrigator ourselves within the Duxton Group. We've come to the water investment from that view of how we, how we know within our own agricultural operations, the benefits of some risk management, some visibility to some of the emerging products within the water market.
But you're not a charity. You're there to make money.
No, but, neither are the agricultural businesses that we ultimately engage with. They're for-profit businesses. But our view is that we're in there to provide a long-term relationship, build long-term relationships with our irrigation partners, to provide them with capital flexibility, provide them with visibility to water.
I do want to clarify, though, what you mean about your commitment to long-term rights, because, you'll be familiar with the assertions that were made. You were on the front page of the Australian newspaper not very long ago. Australia's biggest olive grower, Rob McGavin from Boundary Bend, said that you were actually amassing huge amounts of water in both long-term rights and on the spot market. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, we provided some information this month. We provide a monthly update to the market about our position in the market and how we've built our portfolio. And ultimately, that stated that we're not hoarding water. We've got we're currently holding approximately 16 gigalitres of usable water, and a lot of that is committed to our irrigation partners. It's committed to.
But are you trading in the spot market though?
So we actively manage our usable water component, and that's in order to meet our obligations and our long, forward-looking obligations to physical water delivery.
An allegation has been made that you borrow tactics from the financial and futures markets and use them in the water market, that you take small parcels of water, put them into a larger parcel of water, and that influences the price. Do you do that?
Well, no. I mean, do we actively manage our portfolio of allocation in order to deliver on our future water requirements? Do we use our own entitlements to assist in delivering on that and the market to assist in delivery of forward-looking water our water commitments and spot requirements? Yes, but we're not.
And do you make money out of that?
Well, yes, but so does our, so do the counterparties that ultimately we're providing water to. Their job, their role, an irrigator's view is.
So if everyone's winning, where's the money coming from?
Which fund?
Well, you're saying
from?
Everyone in this process is making money out of it.
No, well, I'm saying we're in the business of providing water supply and water security to enable our counterparties to ultimately risk manage their water security water input requirement, and yes, we do that. We're a for profit company, and as I said, as are our counterparties in the market.
That's Duxton Capital's Director of Water Assets, Alastair Walsh, speaking there to Hamish McDonald. Let's stay with water because the head of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority says an interim report card shows good progress has been made this year as a result of the Basin Plan. MDBA Chief Executive Philip Glyde says it's important communities and politicians look past the current drought and stick with the plan to ensure its full potential can be met. He was speaking at the Murray-Darling Association conference in Toowoomba yesterday and admitted there's still more work to be done.
It's a mixed report card. If you look back since 2012 and look at what's been achieved, there's a lot has been achieved. So if you think about this reform recovers, is intended to remove 20% of the water that was being used by farmers and others in consumption and giving that back to the environment. The vast majority of that has been recovered. There's over 2,000 gigalitres that sits in as permanent water entitlements with the environmental water holder. That means if a bunch of projects that improve the efficiency of water use are completed in the next 4 or 5 years, that water recovery largely has been finished within the basin. And if you think about how large that task is, that over that to take out that 20% of water, and yet the economy of the basin has grown, the irrigated agriculture economy has grown over that time, the population has grown. Now, that's amazing when you think that we've taken 20% of the water away. Now, there are other factors that have helped those economies to grow, and those averages also mask some pretty large impacts on individual communities. So those communities that were particularly irrigation dependent, that might have been hit by other things such as drought or by world commodity prices being unfavourable, by a whole range of things. There are communities right across the basin that are struggling, and again, I'll point to that what we are clearly seeing is really differential experiences of that economic story. There are communities that are suffering, and there are communities that have improved over the course of the plan.
What about environmentally? Have there been improvements? What does the report card show in terms of the environment?
If we look at the environmental story, it's very hard to see some environmental successes given that we're in such a long drought at the moment. But rest assured, the evidence shows that we're in a better situation environmentally than we were in 2012, despite some negatives. So we've seen, at a local scale, we've seen some improvements. For example, areas where a species was extinct in southern part of the Darling, that species has been reintroduced from South Australia successfully. However, you look on the other side, the fish kills in Menindi in January and December and last year and January this year indicate we've got a long way to go to restore the basin to health. And so they're just a few of the examples that we'll be using where, stepping back and looking over the last 5 years, significant improvements have been made. This is a world-leading reform. No other nation has done what we've done to the extent we've done. And yet I think if you ask most people in the basin today and in the room here at the conference, they'd say that things we're really struggling. And so we've got to balance that sort of long-term look versus the short-term reality that people are experiencing.
Do you think that it's fair to assess the environmental progression with the plan, given, you know, the northern part of the basin has been in drought, some areas 6-7 years?
Yeah. Well, so I think that's a really good question, because what we're obliged to do is try and look through the fact that we have a drought and see whether or not we're better off as a result of having returned water to the environment. And the answer to that is an unambiguous yes. However, if you're sitting alongside one of the rivers in the Northern Basin where the dams are, if there is a dam that might be at 2% storage, very hard to see that there's an environmental gain that has occurred. The Basin Plan won't change the impact of drought. That's going to come and go. What we're trying to do is improve the resilience of the system to those perturbations. And so the whole idea is to, and our task is to look through the drought impacts and try and find what the overall improvement is. And that's going to take generations, because we've had 100 years of unwitting over-allocation of the resource, and you can't turn around 100 years of environmental degradation in 5 years, in 10 years or 12 years. It's going to take a long while to restore some of these ecosystems to health, and some of them won't be. We can't go back to pre-settlement conditions. We've got a working basin now. We want to make it a healthier working basin.
That's Philip Glyde, the Chief Executive of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, and he was speaking there with Lydia Burton. It is 25 past 12 on the Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway, and look, we've been hearing many stories lately of people turning agricultural waste into high-value products. Well, there's some interesting ones that are being developed right here in Adelaide at a new research consortium led by the University of Adelaide. Products like sunscreen made from mushroom waste, healthy skincare products from apples and berries, and high-tech materials made from Brussels sprout stalks. For more on this, I spoke to University of Adelaide Professor Vincent Ballone, who says the consortium plans to create new post-farmgate industries worth over $100 million a year to South Australia.
So there's a multitude of compounds that we're interested in. For instance, anthocyanins from apples, cherries, potatoes, and berries. A polymer called chitosan, but also vitamin D from mushrooms. We will also work with carbohydrate polymers such as cellulose, which is present in basically every single plant, and that can be converted to make super strong materials. And this polymer cellulose is also biodegradable and recyclable, which has a great advantage compared to synthetic polymers.
And where are you sort of at with these projects? Like, how long are you anticipating until you have like a product available for testing?
So some of the research has actually started already and will continue from previous programs. We have already done quite a lot of investigations on sunscreen materials, for instance, derived from chitosans and small molecules that absorb UV radiations. And we have already prototypes that show that the material we have made blocks UV radiations and can be used in sunscreens, skincare products, and other health-promoting products. This is one example. And we have also started to work on anthocyanins, for instance, from different types of crops, and we will use them in food colorant, but also exploit them in other products because of their antioxidant properties, for instance, nutraceuticals and all kinds of other applications as well. So we have already started to work on these different crops.
I mean, war on waste is huge at the moment. We're hearing so many different things that are being done to try and capitalise or stop that waste, but also help farmers, you know, value add to what they're doing. How many farmers in South Australia are you working with, and what do you see as the economic or the potential economic benefits through the products you're working on?
So to make a product viable or to do this work and make it commercially viable, we should not just concentrate on a single molecule from the biomass, even if it's very valuable. It is typically minor in the biomass. So the principle of the research we're going to do is to sequentially extract as many valuable compounds as possible from each crop and derive these different molecules into a multitude of commercial products so that at the end we are left with a minimal amount of residue. So we want to use, in other words, as close to 100% as possible of the biomass to make a whole range of commercial products that will be relevant to a multitude of sectors.
And so you're working with farmers in South Australia, but you're also working with agricultural industries and groups interstate and internationally as well.
That's right. So we have actually a total of 18 partners in the consortium program, involving many local growers, but also international academic partners and also international companies that are interested in developing commercial products from the biomass. And I should also add that the project will keep expanding and we will integrate additional partners in the course of the project. So additional growers are welcome to join the project, for instance, and also other industries that bring new and complementary expertise. So we welcome new partnerships for the next 4 years.
That was University of Adelaide Professor Vincent Ballone, who is very keen to hear from producers who'd like to get involved or are thinking about it. You can contact him on 83132292. That's 83132292, or you can email vincent.ballone, B-U-L-O-N-E, at adelaide.edu.au. And I'm keen to head out to the lab and find out a bit more about that sunscreen, which is made from mushroom waste. Is that something that you would use? 0467 922 783. Alternatively, you might not want to pitch it here, but if you've got an idea that you think could be made from waste, some form in the agricultural sector, whether it's from fruit or vegetables, I'd love to hear your suggestions. 0467 922 783. How would you turn, or what product would you turn agricultural waste into? It is just after 12:30 on the Country Hour. Let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Gary John Lysart.
Good afternoon. The state government will help fund 150 traineeships with Drake Supermarkets as the company expands its operations in Adelaide's northern suburbs. Drake's opened a multi-million dollar distribution centre in Edinburgh 3 weeks ago after leaving the Foodland Group. SA Water says it recently met with the Cooper PD Council after the state government called on them to provide their expertise. The utility recently met with Cooper PD Council Administrator Tim Jackson to discuss the status of the town's water network. Melbourne Cup winning trainer Darren Weir has made his first court appearance after he and two associates were charged with animal cruelty and conspiracy offences, and 145 drivers travelling from Victoria to South Australia were caught concealing fruit in their cars during a two-day blitz at Bordertown. The two-day random roadblock happened in the lead-up to the Labor Day long weekend earlier this month. And there'll be more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Gary. And that is something we'll be following a bit more on the Country Hour tomorrow about really, well, how South Australia is taking Victorians' money. 1 in 5 they're getting fined at that October long weekend. I mean, we'd probably really prefer not to, because the message is really simple, isn't it? Don't bring fruit and vegetables into South Australia. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, and it's good afternoon to senior forecaster Brett Gage.
Good afternoon, Isabella.
It's I'm stating the obvious here, but it's hot. What's happening, Brett?
Yeah, it's warming up, and it's going to become very hot tomorrow. Particularly in the west of the state, we're looking at maximum temperatures in the high 30s or low 40s, and up around the mid 30s in the east of the state. And we've got a vigorous cold front, which should reach around Nullarbor late morning, and then extend eastwards during the day to reach a line near Maree to Clare to Robe in the late evening. Now, ahead of the change, there'll be some thundery, some thundery activity today up in the far northwest and the far northeast corners. But then it should move down from the north during tomorrow, and also a bit of thundery activity associated near the front as it moves across. So for tomorrow, we've got a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the north and west, reaching a medium chance in the far north, and extending into the southeast of the state during the evening. Now, the other main thing tomorrow is after the sun comes up, those northerly winds will really strengthen tomorrow. So we're looking at areas of raised dust over most of the state. Over the north and west of the state. So over Eyre Peninsula and the pastoral districts, the north of the Flinders, some areas of raised dust with those strong northerly winds ahead of the change. And then pretty fresh to strong west to southwesterlies behind the change as well. So it'll be windy on both sides, and particularly behind the change in the west could be pretty strong and squally. So a severe weather warning is possible for tomorrow. There'll be fire danger. The fire danger looks like it'll be severe in parts of the state, and possibly even extreme. So we'll be issuing a fire weather warning this afternoon for tomorrow. Also, marine warnings are current, and there could even be some severe thunderstorm warnings issued tomorrow. So those warnings will gradually come out later today and tomorrow. So keep an eye out. It's looking like a pretty nasty day, really, all up. And with those possibility of thunderstorms as well, you know, that dry lightning could cause issues. So people should be extremely careful in a fire weather sense tomorrow. And then that front will move through eastern parts of the state early Friday morning, and move up to around Moomba around midday. We'll have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms over central and eastern parts of the agricultural area early morning, and then also east of about the Stuart Highway during the day up in the pastoral districts. And there'll be a weak cold front, well, not a weak cold front, it'll be embedded in some pretty strong west to southwest winds. But a cold front moving across the southeast of the state overnight Friday, bring us a slight chance of thunderstorms and possible small hail to the lower southeast coast Friday night, and then extending over the lower southeast district on Saturday morning. On Saturday there will be a ridge of high pressure moving in from the west. So cold southwesterly winds, strong at first about southern coast, but those winds will moderate during the day because a high pressure system will ridge in from the west, and it should be centred over the Bight by Sunday morning. So we'll see winds easing quite significantly. So back to just light to moderate southwest to southeasterly winds on Sunday. Cool in the south and warm in the north. And for Sunday, just a slight chance of showers about southern coast and ranges and over the southeast district. So our cumulative rainfall totals until midnight Sunday are generally only expected to be up to 2 millimetres, but reaching 2 to 5 millimetres with thunderstorms and about the southern coasts and ranges, and slightly higher totals of 5 to 10 millimetres expected in the lower southeast.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Brett. Going to be a really nasty conditions tomorrow. Let's have a look at the far west of New South Wales. And for the upper western district, it'll be a sunny day tomorrow with overnight temperatures between 17 and 20. And then during the day, it's going to reach the mid to high 30s. For the lower western district, a hot day tomorrow with a sunny morning. Areas of raised dust in the afternoon. Overnight, it's going to be between 15 and 18, and then during the day it'll reach the mid to high 30s.
Inspired choice or a desperate publicity stunt?
Senate sits tomorrow and every vote will be crucial.
Critics are calling ABC TV's Total Control unmissable viewing.
Hi, I'm Senator Alex Irvin.
Senator?
Yeah, we come in a range of colours.
In a league of its own.
Don't you ever pull a stunt like that on me again.
The critically acclaimed political drama starring Oscar nominee Rachel Griffiths and Deborah Mailman. Total Control, Sunday night 8:30 on ABC TV and iView.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
Where it is 20 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Great to be in your company this Wednesday. A company that claims it can control the weather is gaining momentum in the Victorian grain belt, where a group of farmers have paid for rain throughout the growing season. David Miles has been marketing rain to farmers for more than a decade and says he is making millions of dollars from farmers and investors. Scientists and government departments have branded Mr. Miles a hoax. But the competition watchdog says his company is very difficult to regulate. Danny Grindley reports.
David Miles not only claims he can make it rain, he says he can also stop the rain, but not just for anyone.
We've had phone calls. Can you make sure we have a sunny day for our wedding? You know, and so we really don't do public events. We've done a few favours for a couple of people, but that's it.
His company targets farmers. In 2006, it was called Acquiesce and was labelled a cruel hoax by the Victorian Department of Primary Industries. It's since rebranded to become Miles Research and is promoting three-month rain contracts to farming regions for $250,000.
A good John Deere tractor's worth $500,000 for 6 months' rain. It's worth a John Deere tractor, isn't it? We're offering rain into any region in Australia that would engage with us on a success basis.
Which means you only pay when it rains.
Well, I got involved because it sounded good, probably like, you know, the fact that you can control weather, because as a farmer, rainfall is everything.
This client, who asked to remain anonymous, is among a group of Wimmera farmers that signed contracts between May and October.
Well, I think the evidence is out there. You look at the forecast, what's meant to come, and all of a sudden it increases dramatically. You know that he's behind it. And I reckon I haven't seen such good crops in this district either, everywhere.
Along with farmer clients, Mr. Miles says he's secured several million dollars from investors. He will only explain how his company works in vague terms.
We've basically discovered a way that we can modify the flight corridors that allow the rain systems through.
The Miles Research website says this is achieved using electromagnetic scalar waves.
Electromagnetic scalar waves don't exist. There's no such thing.
Associate Professor of Physics Martin Sevier reviewed Mr. Miles' website.
He's taken a few words and put them together and made them sound somewhat scientific, but it's meaningless. You can say the words, but they mean nothing.
Well, I think electromagnetic and scalar waves in the same phrase is nonsensical, but somehow people have put that together.
You put it together on your website.
All right. There is information that's a little bit obscure, because that's a way of firewalling the core intellectual property so that it can't be weaponized and used to harm nations.
Secrecy. To ensure someone doesn't use his technology to flood a country or region. It's the same reason given when clients ask to see Mr. Miles' equipment, which none of them have.
We've been advised early on when they said to us not to patent, but rather try and keep it a little bit like Coca-Cola, a secret split up in multiple locations.
One client said he asked to see the outside of one of the shipping containers, of which Mr. Miles says there are many. Mr. Miles said no.
You know, a sceptic will say, well, therefore it doesn't exist. And, okay, I think that's a naive approach. We haven't presented the device, But we have the means to present a device. We're trying to say to people, judge us on the result.
Mr. Miles' evidence is rainfall above what was forecast by the Bureau of Meteorology. Associate Professor of Meteorology Todd Lane specialises in thunderstorms and rainfall.
Rain is probably the most difficult thing to forecast. The accuracy of these forecasts, while they do add value, there's so much uncertainty associated with these seasonal predictions. It's not particularly surprising if we get really wet conditions based on a dry forecast or drier conditions based on a dry forecast.
So when rain comes, Miles research customers pay. When it doesn't, Mr. Miles has an explanation.
I mean, the classical one was a week or so ago. He's went to bed at half past one thinking the job's under control, and by 3 o'clock it had changed.
So what did that mean?
Well, that means the event that was coming, they got it in South Australia, but we didn't get it here.
In terms of regulation, it's very difficult to prove Mr. Miles isn't causing rainfall. Mick Keogh is Deputy Chair of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission.
You know, you can put psychics, water diviners, astrologers, all sorts of questionable services into the same category. If you wanted to prosecute, a court requires you to prove, you know, essentially that there's no basis for the claims being made. And that is a very difficult thing to do.
You are a farmer. Can you see why farmers would be attracted to it?
Certainly having experienced the millennium drought, you get to a point sometimes of wondering whether it ever will rain again. So I guess you would get to a level of desperation about things that might work. But in cold, hard, practical terms, it's preying on people's desperation, it seems to me, as an individual, to be engaging in this sort of promises. But it's up to individuals, obviously, to make their own mind up. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
That's ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh ending that report from Danny Grindley.
The South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it's 15 minutes to one, moving to the dairy industry now. And South Australia's milk production has recorded double-digit declines for the first few months of this season. It's the third smallest milk pool in Australia, but with a huge geographical spread of farms, production is expected to rebound in coming months. That's according to Dairy Australia, which released its Situation and Outlook Report update today. Simone Smith spoke with Dairy Australia senior analyst John Droppett about how production was tracking for the state up until the end of September.
So season to date, our preliminary numbers suggest South Australia is down about 13% in milk production for September itself compared to last year, but also works out at 13% for the year to date, so 3 months to September. So totally around about 100 million litres for the year to date, and tracking third smallest behind Queensland WA.
How do you expect it to go for the rest of the season?
I think it's going to depend on water availability and rainfall. South Australia came out of last season in a bit more of a robust state, I guess, compared to some of the more drought-affected regions. And while the season's been fairly neutral for a lot of farmers so far, the outlook is fairly dry for at least the southeast part. So I think South Australia is going to be pretty patchy, and I would expect that 13% drop we've seen so far will possibly improve somewhat. But again, it's going to depend on how this dry seasonal outlook plays out.
South Australia has two very different dairy regions. It has the southeast, which generally supplies export products to export processors. Further north, it's more domestic focused. In terms of milk production and farmgate milk prices, how big is the spread in South Australia, and does that reflect in profitability?
I think the spread is probably as large as anywhere, because, you know, again, those regions closer to Adelaide that do supply, you know, the fresh milk market are on a completely different pricing structure to so those in the southeast who are supplying an export processor. It's not to say that there aren't some in the southeast, you know, on a flat payment structure as well. But so the structure of those payments is, you know, hugely different. And of course, you know, depending on how you apply that to the farming system, then the total will be different as well. And how it applies to productivity really, or profitability really, depends on, you know, again, the farm itself and how well adapted they are to the pricing system they're on in the southeast that's, you know, fully able to capture, you know, cost advantages of producing grass right when they need it compared to someone that's, you know, that might be on a flatter structure and still have seasonal issues to deal with. You know, you've got a whole range of abilities amongst different farmers to farm different systems, and they've got different constraints as well. So some years a flat structure is going to work really well for those guys on a flat milk pricing system, and similarly in some years those on a seasonal sort of operation are going to get hit at the wrong time with rainfall or miss their rainfall at the wrong time and get caught having to play catch up.
That was Dairy Australia senior analyst John Droppett speaking there with Simone Smith. Well, the National Farmers Federation is calling on all three levels of government to coordinate a cull of Australia's 24 million strong feral pig population. It comes amid a growing feeling that feral pigs will be largely responsible for the spread of African swine fever if it enters the country. Tony Maher is the chief executive of the National Farmers Federation and says the time is right for a nationally coordinated cull.
Right now, at the moment, it's a good time to actually take these steps. We're obviously experiencing devastating drought, and the last thing we need is further difficulties and challenges from pests such as pigs. So it certainly seems like a good time at the moment for the government to initiate such an initiative, and notwithstanding the drought, but also, you know, possibly linked to the African swine fever risk that we know is on our doorstep.
So have you got specifics of what you want? How much funding you want to be put toward this? What sort of resources? What control methods could be used?
Look, we haven't gone into that level of detail. We've just been talking about it at our NFF Members' Council last week, and it had unanimous support for us to talk with government, and we have been talking with them around a range of measures, obviously relating to the drought, and it became apparent that this could be another area where the government could assist the industry and take some steps, particularly at the moment, around controlling feral pests such as pigs.
Do you think the feral pig problem has flown under the radar or crept up on the government, and now we're at a point where there's 24 million feral pigs out there and it might be difficult to wind that back?
Well, I think it's been an ongoing issue, and I think right now, just at the moment, it's being exacerbated because of the conditions that a large part of the country is facing in terms of drought. So, you know, they're appears like it's a good time to actually do this sort of thing. Now, we could debate about whether it's gotten out of control, but right now it's looking for measures that will make a difference. And if we could get some sort of process in place or project in place where the government worked with local communities, state governments, whoever it might be, to actually help control this pig problem.
How difficult do you think it would actually be to have a meaningful impact on feral pig numbers?
Oh, look, I think not underestimating the challenge. I mean, it's going to take a pretty significant impact, and that's where, again, I think we probably need cooperation across Commonwealth and state, and possibly, you know, local governments as well. So, but if we continue to let it go, you know, it's not going to get any better.
Pigs are obviously a big problem in public land, but also on private land. So do you think there should be support, for maybe financial support for farmers to tackle the problem on their own properties?
Yeah, look, I think it's got to be on public and private land. We know in national parks they anecdotally tend to go from one region or one park or one boundary to another, and if it's not a comprehensive response, then, you know, the measures can be wasted and can be inefficient. So certainly on public and private land, so whether that's incentives or you know, some sort of assistance to make sure that farmers can control or help control some of the pests, and, you know, we'd be open to that as well. It's got to be a comprehensive process. You're not going to be able to just have a piecemeal response to this thing. And as I say, the timing for us seems right now at the moment in the middle of a pretty devastating drought.
That was Tony Maher, Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation, speaking there to Angus Verley. And Federal Agriculture Minister Bridget McKenzie has been contacted for comment. On the flip side, pig prices have rallied over the past few months to bring some much-needed relief to pork producers. Pig farmers have struggled with the low commodity prices and high feed prices. However, T&D pig marketer Gary Tiss says the recent bump in prices has given pig producers the chance to deal with debts that they've racked up.
pig prices have increased quite considerably since we probably last spoke. In fact, just at the moment, they're probably about a dollar, or anywhere from a dollar sort of 40 to $1.60 dearer than what they were 12 months ago. And most of that gain has been in the last probably 2 months. Just not enough pigs to go around at the moment.
What prices are pig producers fetching at the moment?
Last week, some people hit over $4 a kilo. There's certainly too many people getting less than probably about $3.90 a kilo currently. And in fact, I think you'll find that pig prices in the next couple of weeks will probably, well, like I say, no one should be under $4 a kilo. A lot of prices up are over $4, getting up around $4.10, $4.15.
So what do you think is actually causing this increase in price?
Well, the national slaughter numbers have gone from probably about 115,000 pigs a week back to currently we're probably sitting on about 90,000 because numbers have really dried up because of the summer infertility problems we've had. We expect that to sort of tend to right itself end of October, maybe November. Numbers will start coming on a bit again, but then, of course, demand increases as well. So we don't really anticipate prices will go down at all.
So are prices now at a level where they're actually meeting the cost of production?
Yeah, I think most places should be making a little bit at the moment, but we're all sort of still suffering a bit of a hangover when prices were low. And I think you'll find a lot of big producers have to pay back debts incurred from the real low prices and the high feed prices as well.
Will this be too little too late then for some people?
Yeah, I think pig farmers are pretty resilient. Those that were going to go out are gone out. And I think the ones that are in there at the moment will hang in there and well, let's say they've survived and should carry on from now because I think with looming African swine fever on our doorstep, if that does come into Australia, there's a lot of uncertainty as to what's going to happen with pig production, also whether people will accept the fact that pigs have got swine fever, whether the general public out there will say, well, it's safe to eat.
Should swine fever reach the retail shores, do you think that would probably be it for a lot of pig producers in Australia, wouldn't it?
If you do get it, unfortunately, yes. We're just hoping that we can step up our biosecurity. Even that's hard to do because you can't keep the flies out of a piggery and you can't keep the birds out of a piggery. And it's just I don't know. Unfortunately, I think it's maybe just a matter of time that it gets into Australia and then gets into the wild pig population. That's what we're mainly concerned about, and they will spread it very quickly.
That's pig auctioneer and farmer Gary Tiss speaking to Lucas Forbes. Let's head off to the markets now. And here's John Traeger with the cattle results from Dublin.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased again this week with agents offering 750 live weight cattle and 250 open auction calves to a good field of local and interstate processors, especially butchers and restockers. Competition was generally good with one interstate processor not represented. Quality was again extremely mixed and included drafts from the Port Augusta and Menindee Lakes pastoral areas. However, some ideally conditioned supplementary fed younger cattle came forward. Store conditioned pastoral steer vealers sold to restockers from 232 to 272 cents, with C3 descriptions of the trade selling from 240 to 280 cents a kilo. Extremely light vealer heifers were entirely pastoral bred, with restockers bidding 150 to 182 cents. Medium weight C3 description sold at the trade from 200 to 274, a drop of 10 to 15 cents a kilo, with heavyweight C3s receiving 232 and 250 cents and backed by a similar amount. Extremely light pastoral bred yearling steers sold from 180 to 248 cents to restockers, with heavyweight C3 types of the trade receiving 240 to 285 cents and down by 5 to 10 cents a kilo. Light yearling heifers sold firm from 220 to 230 cents, with C3 medium and heavyweights of the trade selling 15 cents a kilo cheaper from 228 to 252 cents a kilo. Grown steers sold from 200 to 280 cents, with grown heifers receiving 174 to 246 cents a kilo. Light cows sold firm from 140 to 168. Medium weights improved 5 to 10 cents to sell from 178 to 240 cents, with heavyweights firm and selling from 236 to 240 cents a kilo. Light and mostly pastoral belt bulls sold from 180 to 210 cents, with heavy bulls of the trade firm and selling from 216 to 244 cents a kilo. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. And Peter Kerr has the Southeast cattle market results.
Good afternoon, Isabella. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 23rd of October. Numbers rose sharply as agents shouted 1,222 head of live weight and open auction cattle with a lift of 500 head on the previous sale. These sold to a larger field of trade and processor buyers with both feeders and restockers operating across the market. Quality continues to improve week on week with more condition amongst the pens, including a number of grain-fed types, however some secondary types were still spread over the market. Pricing ending up being mixed as yearling steers eased, yearling heifers increased, heavy cows stayed steady, while the heavy steers and bullocks suffered the biggest drop of 15 to 18 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers to the trade range from 258 to 320, with similar heifers returning from 230 to 299. Feeder steers range from 276 to 340 cents, with feeder heifers ranging from 246 to 280 cents a kilogram. Restockers are active on steers from 280 to 301 and on heifers from 200 to 287. Growing steers and bullocks range from 250 to 316 cents, as growing heifers range from 238 to 289, with the manufacturing steers returning from 194 to 262 cents a kilogram. Heavy cows stay firm in price from 222 to 255, as the lighter selection range from 145 to 216, as bulls range from 210 to a high of 300 cents a kilogram for a single outstanding short-horn bull. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Peter. And on the rain salesman story, Peter from Panola says that there's one born every minute when it comes to suckers. And Craig from Salter Springs saying here, my question is, how do they form square clouds to stop neighbours not paying for the service from receiving the rainfall benefit? It is coming up to news time, 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.